It's Thursday, March 3rd, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm David Byrd in Washington. Coming up, what's ahead for campaign 2016?
What the establishment hopes is that they win enough so that they deny Trump the delegates he needs to secure the nomination in advance of the convention.
The U.S. military captures an Islamic State operative in Iraq. The U.N. imposes new sanctions on North Korea. The Supreme Court hears arguments on a landmark abortion case. And astronaut Scott Kelly returns to Earth after a year on the space station. That's all ahead on VOA's International Edition. The U.S. presidential campaign is entering a key phase after Super Tuesday turned out to be a big day for Republican frontrunner Donald Trump and former Secretary of State Hillary Clinton. Trump and Clinton both won 7 primaries. On the Republican side, Texas Senator Ted Cruz took 3 and Marco Rubio won 1. In Democratic primaries, Bernie Sanders took 4 states. I spoke with VOA's national correspondent Jim Malone about what we can expect next as the campaign heads towards primaries and caucuses that are winner take all.
I think we're in the most crucial 2 weeks of the campaign as it pertains to any remaining hope by the Republican establishment that they can stop or derail Donald Trump. The time to do that is now. Frankly, it was probably before this. But I think you're going to see one last effort. It won't be by the entire establishment, because I think there's a split there. Some people have already made their peace with Trump as the likely nominee. Look at Chris Christie, the governor of New Jersey, who's appearing with Trump in many places where he goes. I think you're going to see a concerted effort to see that by March 15th, where you have 5 major states voting, including Ohio, Florida, North Carolina, Missouri, and Illinois, that's probably the last opportunity to stop. What it means is that John Kasich, the governor of Ohio, must win his home state on that day. And most of all, Marco Rubio must find a way to overtake Donald Trump in his home state of Florida. He's been trailing badly in the polls for weeks. He needs to turn it around quickly if he has any chance to stay in the race.
Now, there's word that Mitt Romney, the nominee in 2012 against President Obama, will make a major, quote-unquote, major policy speech or a major speech later Thursday. Is it possible that Romney could get in and try to do this?
Most of the experts we're hearing from do not think Romney's about to jump into the race. I think he may weigh in on the race and most likely would kind of be a voice of the Republican establishment at this point, but I think everyone's going to be quite interested to hear what he has to say. Don't forget that on the campaign trail, Donald Trump has not hesitated to kind of dismiss Mitt Romney's run in 2012, said it was a race he should have won, we had a poor candidate, etc. No love lost there. And I think Romney is a perfect example of someone who is concerned by the prospect of Trump becoming the nominee, and the worry is that he could lose badly to the likely Democratic nominee, Hillary Clinton.
Looking towards November, are we looking at a convention fight between the people who support Trump and the people who are saying, hey, look, this guy will lose the White House for us?
I think there's a lot of interest in seeing if Trump could be derailed. Here's how it would happen, by the way. I don't think you could see Cruz or Rubio overtaking Trump in the delegate count and outright winning at this point. That's not the way it's headed. What the establishment hopes is that they win enough so that they deny Trump the delegates he needs to secure the nomination in advance of the convention. That means that going into Cleveland in July, Trump would not be the for sure nominee, and it would lead to sort of a contested convention where all kinds of things could happen. It's still a long shot because of the way Trump has built momentum. And by the way, once we hit March 15th, including states like Ohio and Florida, the rules for the party say some of those states are winner-take-all. So Marco Rubio losing to Donald Trump in the Florida primary would be really catastrophic for his chances.
And we have to mention that Dr. Ben Carson, the pediatric neurosurgeon who had been in the race, has decided, he said, there's no path forward for his campaign. So now we're down to 4. Trump, Rubio, Cruz, and John Kasich.
That's right. And, you know, Ben Carson had a kind of meteoric rise there for a while. He actually led the field some months back. But things came out about his background, the way he handled himself in certain situations. And frankly, sometimes his approach in the debates kind of left him on the sidelines, I think, for this race for the most part. You could then ask, where will his support go, the little there is of it? And I think the candidates will want to try to take advantage of that, but it probably won't make a huge impact. I think, as Ted Cruz said on Super Tuesday night, the only way probably to really beat Trump at this point is for all the rivals to get behind one alternative, but we're not seeing any sign of that yet.
That's VOA national correspondent Jim Malone. You can follow all of Jim's reporting on campaign 2016 by logging on to our website, voanews.com. For more on the campaign, we turn now to our social media reporter, G. Abby Lee. Hello, G.
Hi, Dave.
Let's begin with Ben Carson. What did he have to say on Twitter?
Like Jim said earlier, Carson announced he's ending his presidential campaign. He's on Twitter at RealBenCarson and tweeted this. Read my statement on this Thursday night's hashtag GOP debate. Click here, and that link takes you to his campaign page. He wrote, I do not see a political path forward in light of last evening's Super Tuesday primary results. He added, he will not attend Thursday's debate.
Now, he is not the only GOP candidate people are talking about, right? What's the latest on the back and forth between frontrunner Donald Trump and South Carolina Governor Nikki Haley?
Yes, Donald Trump, as many of our listeners already know, is a GOP frontrunner, and South Carolina's Governor Nikki Haley endorsed his rival, Marco Rubio. So naturally, they're not a fan of each other. His latest tweet targeting her reads like this. The people of South Carolina are embarrassed by Nikki Haley. Her response was pretty short and sweet. Bless your heart. A reply with the most number of likes to that tweet says, that's Southern for bleep, bleep, bleep. It's a bit hard to explain what it is, but I would say bless your heart is a way of saying something quite cutting without actually saying it. Dave, what do you think?
Well, I grew up in the South, and when a woman in the South says, oh, bless your heart, she's really saying, you know, I really disagree with what you just said. And so that's Nikki Haley's way of kind of, you know, picking up a Southern colloquialism to kind of give the backhand to Mr. Trump.
And I'm sure a lot of GOP members love that kind of response.
Oh,
Southern,
yeah.
But also quite sassy.
Yeah. So what else do we have from the Republican side?
It's about New Jersey Governor Chris Christie. Six newspapers from the state urged him to resign. And in the joint editorial about him after his endorsement of Trump, they wrote they are fed up with his opportunism. The editorial also said he spent 261 days outside of the state.
Thanks for that analysis. You can follow G. Abby Lee on Twitter. She is at G. Abby Lee. That's JEEABBEYLEE. This is VOA.
VOA News.
When news breaks, VOA News is there. Around the clock, listen to VOA Newscast at the top of each hour, along with our detailed news programs and analysis.
We are online at voanews.com.
VOA, your trusted source of news and information.
Hello, I'm Carol Castiel, host of Press Conference USA. VOA's weekly newsmaker interview program. Listeners around the globe get insights from authors, analysts, and policymakers on a wide range of topics, from U.S. politics and foreign policy to science, culture, and global health. That's Press Conference USA, every Saturday and Sunday on VOA.
You're listening to VOA's International Edition. I'm David Byrd in Washington. The United States Defense Department says U.S. Special Operations Forces have captured an Islamic State operative in Iraq. The captive is the first known detainee since a U.S. expeditionary force started targeting IS leadership and operations in Iraq and Syria. I spoke with VOA's Pentagon correspondent Carla Babb about the raid and what the U.S. government hopes to gain from this capture.
The Pentagon is not releasing any of the details. They're being very secretive on this, and a defense official spoke to me about the secrecy and said, you know, raids beget follow-on operations. As you learn something from one raid, you can get a follow-on that leads to another. So they don't want to release exactly where he was when he was taken. We know that he's going to be turned over to Iraqi officials. We know that this person was captured in Iraq, but that's pretty much all we know at this point. This expeditionary task force has been conducting operations. Secretary Carter just said Monday that they were conducting these operations. We just didn't know when they started. We don't know how many of these raids they've done, and we don't know where they are now. And the Pentagon is stressing that that is for security purposes so they can continue to conduct future raids.
The Obama administration has had a policy of having special operations forces, SEAL teams, etc., go in small groups to do these kind of raids versus a large land force like an occupying force. Is that the wave of the future in the fight against the Islamic State?
I think that that may be the case. The president has mentioned this. He's made General Votel, who is currently the head of Special Operations Forces Command, he is going to be the new head of Central Command. And in addition to that, we've been hearing from defense officials that when there was a raid done on Abu Sayyaf, if you remember him, he and his wife, there was a raid on a major IS leader, and defense officials tell me that this was kind of an aha moment for the Pentagon, because when they did that raid, they were able to get such valuable information about the oil industry. They were able to have this operation called Tidal Wave 2, which targeted Islamic State oil revenue. And then in addition to that, they were able to take Umm Sayyaf, which is Abu Sayyaf's wife. She was able to provide them with additional information about IS leadership, as well as more information about Kayla Mueller, who, if you remember, was the 26-year-old American aid worker who this IS had allegedly held as a prisoner in their home, and she was killed back in February of 2015. So they learned from this raid. They said, wow, you know, if you're willing to put a little bit of risk into sending people out on raids, you can get such rewards back because the information that happens to come from these raids is very valuable.
That's VOA Pentagon correspondent Carla Babb. You can see more of her reporting on our website, voanews.com. You can also follow her on Twitter. Her handle there is Carla Babb. That's B-A-B-B-V-O-A. The UN Security Council unanimously adopted new hard-hitting sanctions against North Korea on Wednesday. The measures are in response to two recent violations by Pyongyang of international prohibitions on its nuclear and ballistic missile programs. VOA's UN correspondent Margaret Bashir spoke with Ambassador Samantha Power about the sanctions and about China's role in making sure that the new measures stick.
China has a huge role to play, no question, as a neighbor, as a country that still has a lot of transactions with North Korea, where many other countries have hung back and pulled back in order to isolate the regime. But I take it as hugely significant that China supported this resolution, that its hand went up in the air, that it worked so constructively to think through how these very specific provisions might affect different ways that this regime has used to advance this program, that China is very firm. It does not want to see existing so nearby. And China's line to us in the negotiations was, we are not going to allow for the inclusion of any provisions in this resolution that we are not ourselves prepared to implement. And we have the means as an international community, as the United States, of tracking that, of tracking what goes in and out, of tracking how exports are used. And we're going to be watching implementation as aggressively as we sought to negotiate this resolution.
And on Tuesday, North Korea announced that it would boycott the Human Rights Council. I was wondering if you have a reaction to that.
Well, I don't think many diplomats were waiting with bated breath to hear candid discussions by the representatives of North Korea about the grotesque circumstances in which North Korean people are detained, and the starvation and the lack of food and the funneling of resources into the nuclear weapons program instead of into livelihoods and into the welfare of the North Korean people. So I'm not sure we're missing much. But, you know, of course, we want all countries to engage international institutions, but their decision to boycott seems just another act of kind of thumbing its nose at the international community and at the standards and the rules that everybody else plays by.
And finally, Ambassador, I just wondered if you have a message for the people on the Korean Peninsula, both in North Korea and in South Korea.
Well, I don't think I can say it better than the ambassador from Korea, who spoke so movingly in his remarks before the Security Council. But what he said was, you know, put these weapons away, let your people have access to the fruits of the international community, become integrated again. Nobody's threatening you. Nobody wishes ill upon you, the people of North Korea. And to the people of Korea, I would say, you know, we stand with you. We know how alarming it is to share a peninsula with a regime that pursues relentlessly and recklessly nuclear weapons, and we intend to continue to work together to promote your security, which is also our security. We're all connected in this.
That's UN Ambassador Samantha Power speaking with VOA's Margaret Bashir. Also Wednesday, the United States unilaterally widened sanctions against North Korea, a move that complements the UN vote to impose additional penalties on Pyongyang. And early on Thursday, North Korea fired several short-range projectiles into the sea off its east coast, just hours after the UN sanctions. A South Korean Defense Ministry spokesman said authorities were trying to determine exactly what North Korea fired. The projectiles could be missiles, artillery, or rockets. North Korea does have a history of firing weapons from its arsenal when angered at international condemnation. You're listening to VOA's International Edition. This is VOA.
I'm Millar Sega, host of VOA's The Correspondents, a weekly roundup of the top stories with analysis from our dedicated reporters around the globe.
Among the stars expressing support, Frida Pinto.
This is a problem that inflicts almost every country.
Think of it as a conversation on the biggest issues of the day. Wherever the news may be, our correspondents are there. Listen to The Correspondents, Saturdays and Sundays on VOA.
Hi, I'm Larry London, and I'm the host of Border Crossings, inviting you to join me for one of the best hours of request music possible on the radio. We've got all your favorite songs by your favorite singers. You tell us what to play. It's requests and dedications, and it happens every weekday right here on The Voice of America.
You're listening to VOA's International Edition. I'm David Byrd in Washington. The U.S. Supreme Court appeared sharply divided Wednesday as it heard arguments about the country's biggest abortion rights case in nearly a quarter century. It's a dispute that could change the constitutional rights for the procedure and affect huge numbers of women. At issue is a law from Texas governing what medical capabilities abortion clinics have to have in order to perform the procedure. Amy Hagstrom is the lead plaintiff in the case.
I am the CEO of Whole Woman's Health, and I am the lead plaintiff in this case. I am proud to have spent my majority of my professional career caring for women with compassion and dignity and the respect that they deserve when seeking abortion services.
Scott Keller, meanwhile, is Texas's Solicitor General.
This case is not about overturning Roe versus Wade. What this case, the issue in this case, is can Texas enact valid patient regulations that improve safety?
Hundreds of pro-abortion and a smaller number of anti-abortion protesters stood on the court steps Wednesday. The case comes less than a month after the death of conservative Justice Antonin Scalia. VOA's Chris Simpkins was at the court and told me if the high court cannot reach a decision, a lower court ruling will become law.
A Texas law that was enacted in 2013 that requires doctors who perform abortions to have admitting privileges at nearby hospitals. It also prohibits clinics from providing abortions unless they meet the standards of outpatient or ambulatory surgical centers. So the concern is among abortion rights activists is that the doctors performing abortions in these clinics will not be able to meet these standards. Thus, abortion clinics will shut down, and women who need abortions will have to travel great distances and go through a lot of hardship in order to obtain an abortion.
Now, this comes at a time when the court is split between its liberal and its conservative wings at 4-each, because Justice Scalia would have balanced the conservative wing at 5-4 in this case, and President Obama has not appointed a successor to Justice Scalia, and the Republican establishment has said he's not going to get to. We're not going to confirm anyone. What was the sense on the court today? Were the justices asking questions? Were they, were the lawyers able to argue their case, or did it seem like this was just an exercise?
All of the above. The lawyers for both sides were able to argue their case before the 8-member court. The justices all asked questions, but all eyes are on Justice Anthony Kennedy, who is a conservative on the court, but in the past has been a moderate when it comes to abortion rights cases, and actually has voted in favor of some abortion rights rulings. So abortion rights advocates see Justice Kennedy as possibly the swing vote. Now, if the case is unable, if the justices are unable to reach a decision and it's tied at 4-4, the lower court ruling will be upheld, which upheld this Texas law.
That's VOA correspondent Chris Simpkins. You can follow his coverage of this case by logging on to our website, voanews.com. After an unprecedented 340 days in space, American astronaut and Expedition 46 commander Scott Kelly returned to Earth Wednesday aboard a Russian Soyuz space capsule. Along with him came cosmonauts Mikhail Kornienko and Sergei Volkov. They landed in Kazakhstan. The 52-year-old Kelly and the 55-year-old Kornienko arrived together aboard the orbiting International Space Station March 27th of last year. They traveled 230 million kilometers, flew more than 5,400 Earth orbits, and experienced nearly 11,000 sunrises and sunsets. Kelly has now logged the most days in space orbit of any American at 520. Their time on the station is considered key to learning how the human body reacts to long-time spaceflight as the U.S. Space Agency looks toward a mission to Mars. VOA's Victor Beatty spoke with Morris Jones, a spaceflight analyst from Sydney, Australia, about what scientists hope to learn.
This is hardly the first time that we've had a long-duration space mission, and a lot of the symptoms tend to be the same. The bones become more brittle, largely because they lose calcium. The immune system weakens a bit. The cardiovascular system changes because the heart doesn't have to fight gravity when it pumps blood around the body. In recent years, we've also discovered that the health of the eyeball tends to deteriorate because of the body fluid shifting around, and it could have some long-term effects on the optic nerve and possibly on the effect of the astronaut's vision. So bit by bit, as our medical tests become more sophisticated, we're getting a better understanding of not just so much the short term, but also the potential long term effects on the body.
The U.S. and I guess other countries are looking to the future for possible missions to Mars. How long would these journeys be going and coming?
Estimates for how long a trip to Mars would last are quite varied. I mean, at the upper end of the spectrum, some of the really whopper missions would take 3 years to make the round trip, and that would include 1 year on the surface of Mars. But we're talking about short-term trips of possibly between 6 months and a year, depending on how long you stay on Mars, and also depending on what sort of propulsion system you use. And one of the big problems that we're discovering with long-term spaceflight, and also with measuring conditions around Mars itself, is that radiation in deep space space is likely to be the most serious problem. It's difficult to fight the radiation. You can do it with heavy shielding, but that adds to the weight of the spacecraft. And if the spacecraft gets heavier, then it takes longer to get there, which sort of defeats the purpose because you're in space for longer. And that exposes you to more radiation. So that's really one of the biggest problems that we'd face for a long-term mission to Mars.
Morris Jones says that results of the extensive medical testing on Kelly will be important, but will still fall short of conditions in deep space during a Mars mission. And President Obama called Scott Kelly on the phone Wednesday to congratulate him and to thank him for his service to the country. A treasure trove of concert films, handwritten lyrics, diaries, and other artifacts belonging to American singer-songwriter Bob Dylan has been acquired by a consortium of institutions in the western state of Oklahoma. The archive of more than 6,000 items was acquired by the George Kaiser Family Foundation and the University of Tulsa for an estimated $15 to $20 million. Its estimated value is around $60 million. At the heart of the archive is the collection of Dylan's extensive notebooks, in which he first drafted and then meticulously refined many of his songs. Dylan issued a statement saying he is honored that his papers are to be included with the works of Woody Guthrie, and especially alongside all the valuable artifacts from the Native American nations. Plans call for a gallery that will make some of the material accessible to the public, but most of the archive will go to the scholars. The 74-year-old Dylan, born Robert Allen Zimmerman, was inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame in 1988. And smokers in need of a nicotine fix during a flight to, from, or within the United States might find themselves without relief as an electronic cigarette ban goes into effect next month. The U.S. Department of Transportation announced Wednesday that the rule is meant to protect airline passengers from unwanted exposure to aerosol fumes that occur when electronic cigarettes are used on board airplanes. So vape them if you got them, but not on the plane. Thanks for joining us for VOA's International Edition. Tracy Carter directed our program. David Magnus was our engineer. We welcome your comments and questions. Find us on Facebook at VOA Asia. Our Twitter handle is VOA_IE. I'm David Byrd in Washington.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
After a recent meeting with his National Security Council team, President Barack Obama said the only way to defeat ISIL in a way that lasts is to end the chaos and the civil war that has engulfed Syria for the last 5 years. The cessation of hostilities that was agreed to by Russia, the United States, and other members of the International Syria Support Group on February 22nd, and which went into effect February 27th, is a test, Mr. Obama said, of whether the parties involved are truly committed to negotiations. The process agreed to in Vienna is clear: a transition toward a more inclusive, representative government, a new government, a new constitution, followed by free elections. Acknowledging differences with Russia and Iran on the issue, President Obama reiterated his conviction that Syria's new future cannot include Bashar al-Assad.
It's clear that after years of his barbaric war against his own people, including torture and barrel bombs and sieges and starvation, many Syrians will never stop fighting until Assad is out of power. There's no alternative to a managed transition away from Assad. It's the only way to end the civil war and unite the Syrian people against terrorists.
President Obama said that a political settlement that would end the civil war means that all parties could then turn their attention to the crucial task of destroying ISIL.
And that's why the United States will do everything we can to maximize the chances of success in this cessation of hostilities. At the same time, I want to make totally clear that there will be absolutely no ceasefire with respect to ISIL. We remain relentless in going after them.
President Obama noted that the U.S.-led coalition with its local partners and allies is making headway in shrinking the core of ISIL in Syria and in Iraq. ISIL's control of territory has been diminished. Its leaders have been killed. Its flow of foreign fighters has been slowed. Its finances have been disrupted. The fight against ISIL will remain difficult, said President Obama, but we will continue to draw on all elements of our national power, military, intelligence, diplomacy, homeland security, law enforcement, and the strength of our communities. And I am confident that we will prevail.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.